stuff. It was like, yeah, everybody's so kind of weird. I was
okay. For anyone who didn't realise, the notes are out by the entrance door, not on the desks today. And there are two things. There's the usual copies of slides and also a fragment of a book on XML, which I'll talk about in a bit. So homework for Friday is to read chapter 2, which is the first section of this, about XML. It'll reproduce some stuff that's in the lectures and also add some more background. So far, we've talked about quite a lot about heavily structured data, data which is very organized, or you would like it to be very organized, and we've done lots and lots of arranging things in tables, in rectangles, in saying we've got this set of records, and they're all like this, and there's another set of records, and they're all like that, they have the same schema. So now, the next section, if I can get the right machine, is talking about semi-structured data. And semi-structured data is less rigid. It's for situations where you can't impose this or you don't want to impose this. And I'll say a bit about later about what sort of situations that is. But as with structured data, sometimes you had to work a bit with the ER diagram or mapping into SQL to get the data to fit the model that you had available. And the same is true here. Although I say semi-structured data, that suggests it's anything that's a bit short on structure. Actually, it's used in a quite specific sense in this context. And sometimes the data you have may look slightly structured, and it will fit the semi-structured data idea. But again, only partly. Some things will work, some things won't. So there's a lot of overlap here between different approaches. So the next set of lectures will talk about semi-structured data, particularly XML, which is a document representation format for that kind of data, and also corpora. A corpus is a large collection of text, usually annotated in some way to help you analyze it. And this is related to linguistics or things like computer speech, computer textual reading, text-to-speech, and so on. Understanding written English or any written language involves analyzing corpora. So, the background reading, read chapter 2 of this book, an introduction to, no, not on this one, XML and Web Technologies by Malone Schwarzbach, who are Danish, but they read excellent English. And it has this, rather sweetly, the web page for the book. They pick various kinds of blurb and comments from people who've written about it, and Phil Wadler wrote this purple prose to describe how wonderful the book was. And it is actually quite good. It's well worth a read. Again, I'm going to hand out a chapter. If you want to read more, I would encourage you to do so. Find a copy in the library, borrow one, buy one secondhand off somebody who got it last year and has read it, who either has had enough and wants nothing to do with it anymore, or has read it and thinks it's so wonderful that they think other people should read it, or as a last resort, buy a new one. These are good books to have and worth reading. Generally, they will fill out a lot more detail than I can give in the lecture, detail which you can also find on the web or in tutorials and so forth that you might find useful to expand on particular parts that maybe I don't explain in a way that you find easy to do or that simply you want repeated elsewhere. So do read this chapter 2 of the book. It's not a particularly difficult read, but it has got quite a lot more content in than just a lecture. So we've got that relational databases are good for representing data in that's very structured. And if the data is already very structured, or that the questions you want to, or you're expecting to be able to structure it, maybe you set up in advance what the database table is going to be, then that's good. But in lots of situations, you don't have that much structure, or you don't wish to impose that much structure. So this is a completely general situation, but these are some instances where it happens. So if the data just doesn't have any particularly strong inherent structure, you're gathering lots of information, but it's really that any structure it has is not uniform. And this maybe is perhaps the most common case where locally it's pretty structured. So information about books in a library, you'll have particular series or kinds of book where, yes, they all have an author and a date of publication and a place of publication and a number of pages. But then you might find something else which is like magazines or journals or e-books, which kind of have an author but maybe not a place of publication and not a number of pages and so forth. So you can have situations like you might initially think something's really, really structured, and then you come across new cases, new instances, and it's not quite as structured as you thought. The structure varies from item to item. Sometimes we have completely unstructured data. So corpora will be an example of this, where we just have text, or we have a stream of data coming off some experiments, or lots and lots of experimental results, and there really isn't any structure to it at all. But we want to add some structure. So if we have the text from a document, we might want to add structure to indicate how the document is broken up, perhaps grammatically, sentences, clauses, subclauses, and so on, or particular things that words are, adjectives or adverbs or nouns. Or we might want to mark up the meaning, that this is an argument and here's the opening setting the scene, and here is the meat of the argument, and here is a summary part, and then the argument itself is divided into a number of separate points. So we might want to take some very unstructured data and add some more structured information. So we'll get something as a result that's semi-structured. And also, if you have something that initially looks pretty structured, but maybe it's going to change over time. The library database is an example of that, where you start off thinking everything's pretty regular, but actually as you add more and more information appears, then you can either, every time the data changes a little, or the structure of the data changes, you can restructure the whole thing, or you can accept that from the start you're never going to get on top of the structure, you're just going to have to adapt to things changing. So a lot of scientific experimental results are like that, where you're accumulating results from experiments that lots of people have done over time and are continuing to do. You want to put them in some big database so people can compare them and look through them. And you find over time that people, that certain pieces of information you thought you could throw away actually turn out to be important. So people start putting them in their data for the experiments. Or a particular kind of experiment comes along which has data in a different format. And so large scientific databases often have this property that at any point it looks really structured. You have an experiment, this was this big, done by this person and had this data. But over time, the structure, what you want to keep, how you want to keep it, changes. And so you need a model that can cope with the fact that your data is not, the structure is not fixed once and for all. And typically relational databases, fixing the structure is very hard to change the structure. You get a lot of advantage out of that. You get fast queries, you get efficient storage, and if you can manage it, it's really worth having. But if you can't, some situations it's just not worth the trade-off. As I say, semi-structured data just suggests it's data lacking a bit of structure, but it's used in the technical sense almost always to mean something that has a tree structure. So we go from rectangles to triangles is the basic story. First half part of this course is rectangles, we're now doing triangles. And the structure that it takes is a tree. Okay. So by tree, this is not the vegetation biological thing. This is a mathematical construction, which you've probably, I don't know, have you seen trees in, have you seen, that's supposed to change. Go the wrong way around. The reason I'm fussing with this is that something entirely different appears on the video stream. Last time I attempted to do this, it just went completely blank for 20 minutes. So I'm hoping to get some content on the video stream successfully by working this properly. It can't cope with two screens. So this kind of tree. Have you done anything like this in maths and informatics or the maths to maths courses you're doing? Yes, this looks familiar. Okay, so if it doesn't, don't worry, there's more description, more detail in the reading. But a tree, it's a structure. I won't even say a data structure. It's a mathematical structure where, and I'm going to talk about how we talk about trees and then slightly more precisely how they're used for representing semi-structured data. And there'll be two languages to come up. XPath and XML. I'll certainly do XPath this lecture. We might not get onto that much of XML. Depends how it goes. But this really is the trees are a mathematical representation, and they turn up in computer science all over the place. Here we'll be using them to describe documents, but also all kinds of algorithms for sorting, storing, searching, and so forth, or keeping complex data refer to trees. So they're an extremely common data abstraction. So a tree consists of a set of nodes. Nodes here are the circular things. So that is a whole tree. That's the same tree but colored differently. That's not the same tree. So these are four representations of the same tree indicating certain nodes highlighted in red or yellow. And it's a tree. The nodes are linked, usually with a direction. So there's a top and a bottom, and these links go downwards. Confusingly, okay, so that's called the root, the one at the top. These are called branches, and the ones at the ends are called leaves. Confusingly, in maths and computer science, trees are grow upside down. The root is at the top, the leaves are at the bottom. I'm really sorry about that. That's just how it is. It is possible, every now and again, somebody tries to drawing them from the root at the bottom, growing up to the leaves, because that's how it should be. And it never catches on, and people find it difficult to think that way. Essentially because we read from top to bottom in the page. So trees always drawn like that, upside down, root at the top, leaves at the bottom. And then there are various kind of horticultural adjectives used to describe particular kinds of nodes. So you have leaves at the bottom, you have branches or branching, where this branch comes down here and splits there. So sometimes that can be called a fork node. Here we're just going to call them leaves and internal nodes, ones that are not leaves. So leaves are at the end, they have no further ones. There are also various genealogical metaphors where you think of this as a family tree. Of course, it's not a particularly successful family tree because you have individual nodes. This is asexual reproduction, which is not that common. But if you think of them as family trees, so you have a parent of A. These are all single parent families. So a parent of A, if this is node A, then a parent of A is the node above, and the children of A are the nodes below. You can also have sibling nodes. So these two are sibling nodes. Those three are sibling nodes. So this is a sibling of that. So it's always ungendered, I'm afraid. So these are siblings. We don't get in particularly into cousins and sibspring and so forth, but you do get descendants, which are all the nodes below, and ancestors, which are all the nodes above. And if you come across an important notion that you need for an algorithm or data representation or something like that, and there isn't already a name from it, then you reach into either horticulture or genealogy for describing it. So you could kind of talk about mother-in-law nodes and so forth, but it's not. There's always going to be a useful word for the link you need, because it's almost certain that somebody has used this in the real world before you need it in a computer algorithm. But leaves, internal nodes, root, children, siblings, parents is mostly enough. Okay, so we have this general way for describing trees, and it'll come up again and again. Particularly algorithms are often well expressed over trees. Semi-structured data models. Okay, so this is, so I'm going to talk about XPath, which is a model, or a modeling language, but it's not really. So we have, there's going to be a semi-structured data model, and then there's going to be a semi-structured data language. And this is a bit like we had for relational databases, where you had relational algebras and sets of relations and so forth. And then you had a concrete language of SQL, which was like text you could write down and put in a machine and get an answer out. And SQL was the concrete realization of that and had to make all kinds of practical compromises, like what do you do with null and how do you work the syntax out and what happens if your integers turn out to be bigger than you can represent and so on. So it had all kind of practical compromises. And then there was the model, which was a sort of mathematical abstraction of sets that could be as large as you like, and you didn't care about the ordering and things like that. And that's a general concept. And software engineering and program design has a lot of modeling in. You have the idea that there's the thing, which is kind of complex and nasty and has real-world impact. And there's the model, which is somehow a little bit abstracted and nicer to work with, but you can maybe make some more, you can feel better about yourself because you can make clear and harsh decisions and have it pure and well-behaved. And then there's the real thing, which is maybe a little bit more messy and complicated. And the model and the thing may be a long way apart. You may have a high degree of abstraction, or they may be very, very close together. So in this case, the XPath data model is the model, and XML is the concrete language with all the compromises in it. Now, I have to say, in this case, they are like this close together. It is extremely hard to distinguish why one is the model and one is the thing. But that's how we're going to take it at the moment. There's also slightly... So XPath is actually a language for describing routes through these, or originated as language for describing routes, paths through these trees. But it's grown a bit to become really a data model for all trees. So we have the XPath data model, and we're going to use that data model because it corresponds really closely to XML, and XML is really widely used as a semi-structured data model. I'll say a bit about that later. And we've got an example, which is... which slide can we do this on? This is a so-called gazetteer. It's a geographical directory of countries and places and features within that country. And right. So this is a data model. So this is a representation of some data, but it's a little bit abstracted from reality, but not much. And as you can see, it's a tree. We've got some nodes. Nodes and links between them, and we go from the top to the root all the way down to some leaves, and the root, there's a root node that says this is a gazetteer. This is an index or directory of geographical features, and it contains possibly several countries. Here is a country. The country's name is Slovenia. The country's population is 2 million. The country's capital is Ljubljana, and it has some regions, and the regions, it has a region. One might have more regions as siblings. This region has a name, Gorenska, has several features within the region. It has lakes and mountains, and it's very beautiful. So that's some data, and I can describe it, and it clearly has some structure. And in fact, because you have real-world knowledge about places and things like populations and regions and features, then you can interpret that as saying, yes, this is talking about a country, and it has certain things in it. And you could, it would not be hard for you to do a similar thing for a country with which you're familiar, or to extend that with some more information. You can get the gist of what's going on. But of course, for a machine, that's slightly harder. It doesn't necessarily have enough AI to know that this net, what names and populations are, and that region, there's probably more than one, whereas there's likely to be only one capital of the country, there's quite probably more than one region in the country we want to describe, and that name here of region and name of a country are different things, but in some sense quite closely related. They're likely to have similar constraints on what they can be and how they can change and so on. So although reading that, it seems really structured and easy, it's actually, we need to have more so-called metadata to describe these sorts of things that you can read into it just because this is a familiar example. If I'd chosen an example from a field with which you are completely unfamiliar, then you'd probably be slightly confused by it, but again, we could explain it by adding sufficient metadata. So in the XPath data model, you always have a root node, and it always has no content in it at all. So in this case, we're going to have another node, which is the root element, it's called. So you have the root node, and then you have element nodes. So most of these are element nodes, and each element node is labeled with describing the nodes that are going to appear below it. So the internal nodes of this tree are all going to be element nodes. This is a gazetteer. It says it's going to have information about countries. This is a country. All the nodes below it are going to describe that country. This is a region. All the nodes below that are going to describe the region and so forth. So the internal nodes gather together information of a certain kind, and they say, and they have a label that says what kind of information they're gathering. You also have text nodes. So these are the leaves, which have actual pieces of information, like Slovenia, the population, Ljubljana, and the names of the features. There's also, so that covers most of the nodes here. We've got internal nodes, which are describing collections of the children nodes. We have leaf nodes, which have some text in them. And we also have these attribute nodes. These are a little odd. So these are leaf nodes, which take a particular form. They say at type equals lake, and at type equals mountain, and at type equals mountain. So attribute nodes are leaves in which we attach, to which we put an attribute of its parent node. So whereas Ljubljana is just the name of the capital, and Bohinj is the name of this feature, the attribute node says something slightly more second level about it. It says the type of the feature is lake, and there might be other types of feature that you might have. It might be other attributes. So in this case, all of the attributes are just have a type. All of the attributes are the type attribute, but in principle, the features could have other attributes, like you might describe the item or attributes describing who put them in, or when it put them in, or when it appeared, and so on. So to any node, you can attach a bunch of other attribute nodes to refine the description of that particular node. And attributes, we're now becoming a little bit more concrete. Attributes are different to other kinds of nodes. So when we're talking about an XPath data model, if we're talking about a node and its children, we only describe the non-attribute nodes. So we'd say this feature has one child, its name, and it has certain attributes, but they're somehow slightly different. So you can, in some level, this is just a tree, but now we're distinguishing a little bit between certain kinds of leaf nodes. So although the parent of an attribute node, this attribute node has a parent here, it's not a child of that one. And this can get confusing if you're talking about all of the children. So it's worth being aware that there's this slight uncertainty. It's kind of for historical reasons, because this data model was put together to describe pre-existing data sets that have been structured in a slightly ad hoc way, and to say, well, at least we can characterize there are the things, the main nodes, and then there are the attributes that describe them. So, oh no, I do need the tree actually. So we have regular nodes, we have leaves, we have attribute nodes, and to some extent the important stuff is the text in here. That's the actual data onto which we're putting this semi-structure. Much as in a table, you have the data in the table, and then you have the columns and the links and the rows and so on, but the data itself is these things at the bottom. And what that data means, so in a relational database, what a piece of data means depends on the table it's in and the column it's in. In this case, what a particular piece of text here means is the root, the branch on which it lies, so the whole root from the top down to a piece of data. So Ljubljana, the meaning of Ljubljana, the word Ljubljana here, is determined by the fact we're in a gazetteer, this is about a country, and it's the capital of the country. So the route to get to the data tells you what the significance of that data is. So here's another example, Bohinj, the path is /gazetteer/country/region/feature, which tells you that this is a feature in a region in a country represented in this gazetteer. And because feature has some attributes, in this case it has one attribute, it has the attribute type. The type attribute lake, we know that Bohinj is a lake. So to get information about the text at the bottom, you look at the branch all the way down, and then maybe you refine it by looking at some of the attributes on the nodes in that branch. Now, to get more information about Bohinj, like which region it's in, we have to go up and then down again. You start navigating around this tree to say Bohinj is in the region Gorenjska and it's in the country Slovenia. And so you get the branch tells you basic information about it, and if you want to do more refined things, and essentially this is how queries are going to work, then you start navigating around the model. You say, well, if we go up to the region and then down again to find it, its name, what do we get, and so on. So XPath is going to be a language for describing routes through this tree, and then we're going to be interested in queries that involve navigating around the tree, perhaps relative to where you start. If you have a piece of data, its primary meaning is determined by the route through which you reached it, and then related things are, well, what other features are there in this region, what other regions are there in this country, and so on. So okay. So that's the leaves, which is the main part of the data, and their meaning is determined by the root from the root all the way down to the leaf. And the meaning of an internal node is equally determined by how you got there from the root. So here we had name and name. Those are both internal nodes called name, but they mean slightly different things. One is the name of a country, one is the name of a region. And you can establish that because the route to get to this name went through country, and the route to get to this name went through region and country. And so you can see that, and that's exactly what's happening here, that those two nodes are of a different kind because you get to them through different sorts of route. Whereas if we had further countries or further regions, then their name nodes will be essentially the same type as the name nodes are here. So the XPath data model is a slightly abstracted representation of some data that you can keep in a tree. XML, the extensible markup language, is the more concrete realization of this kind of structure in a textual document. So this is fine to put on a slide, but actually, if you're storing it in a database, if you're storing it on a machine or you're querying the machine, so this is represented as pixel by pixel image in my slide. You don't want to store that as your main data store, right? It's happened, but it's a really, really bad idea. You want something that's a bit more compressed than that and captures only the structure. And XML is moving towards that. I should say there is a real risk here with these graphical notations that the graphical notation contains information that you read and you see and you interpret, which may or may not be successfully represented when you take it out of some text-based representation. It can go the other way, but that's less common. So for example here, the relative positioning, the vertical position of the nodes is something that you perceive easily. And also they're kind of clustering where one is underneath another. And sometimes that's not successfully translated into the actual underlying data structure. Here, it probably is because the vertical structuring is done exactly by the node length, the node connections, and the horizontal structuring is exactly just laying it out. But you can get situations where you have diagrams where maybe you have streams of time going down and events happening, and there's something, the fact that something happens before something else, you see visually on the page, but in fact is not represented in the underlying data structure. So you do have to be careful with that. No, I'll leave that up now. Oh, yeah, so one thing that's not necessarily obvious here is that the ordering of the nodes is actually important, the order from left to right. So in general, in a tree, it probably doesn't matter. In the same way that when you draw a family tree, it doesn't necessarily matter. Oh, you probably do put the eldest sibling on the left, right, actually, don't you? But in this data structure, in a real gazetteer, it doesn't matter whether you put the name before the population before the capital, or you put the capital before the name before the population. Certainly, there's no ordering between population and capital information which you should represent. But as it happens in XML, and therefore in the XML data structure, the ordering is crucial. If we swapped around population and capital, we would have a different data structure. Now, that's slightly unexpected, but again, it's for historical reasons to do with the sort of data that was being used. And sometimes people will encode things in that. They will meaningfully use the order of the nodes. So it's worth remembering that this is an ordered tree. Okay, I'll say something about XML. But first I'll do bits and pieces. XML and XPath. So, as I say, data always used to be in rectangles. It's now in triangles. And that's still, I mean, it's fairly settled now that XML and semi-structured data is an established metaphor for, established method for representing data. But it might not last that long. There's a thing called the Copernican principle. This is not examinable. The Copernican principle. So Copernicus was historically one of the astronomers who was involved in making more widely known the fact that the Earth was not the center of the universe. The Sun did not revolve around the Earth. The Earth revolves around the Sun. And in fact, the Sun is not the center of the galaxy, and our galaxy is not the center of the universe. So the Copernican principle is about not being at the center of the universe. And a physicist called Gott, J. Richard Gott III, popularized the Copernican principle as a kind of scientific formalization of the idea that none of us are really that special. Sorry about that. Well, actually, you might be, but most of us are not really that special. And so it's that when you observe something, if you know, even if you know nothing else about it at all, you should, and particularly if you know nothing else about it at all, you should assume that there is nothing particularly special going on. And Gott is most well known for applying this to events that happen over time, the duration of events. So it originated in an observation of the Berlin Wall. Who knows what the Berlin Wall was? Yes. Oh, good. I'm not that old yet. Okay. So there was a wall. It lasted. He observed the Berlin Wall in 1969, and in 1969, it looked pretty permanent. It was a serious feature of the landscape. And he made a prediction about how long it would last. And you could do that by reading up about political history, looking at who is involved, what the power play is between the various countries involved, historically how these kind of things are played out. Or you could just guess. And if you, assuming you know nothing about the politics involved, you could say, we are here. So this is time. We're observing a thing here. And we're observing some event. In this case, it was the lifetime of the Berlin Wall, which started here and is continuing and will continue up to some point in the future. But we don't know how long. So we assume that at some point that the Berlin Wall would have a lifetime. One day it would come down. It might be soon, it might be later. And he was observing it in 1969, when it was 8 years old, when the Berlin Wall was 8 years old. And what his observation was that he was just there as a tourist. He had not come to see the Berlin Wall, particularly. He'd come to see a friend. And so it was probably not going to be that the Berlin Wall would come down that month. That would be astonishingly unlikely, that when strolling past it, he would be the last person to see it up. Equally, so he reckoned that it was quite likely that he was not witnessing the last year of the Berlin Wall, because that would be a bit special. And the Copernican principle says you're not that special. So, and the other thing is that it wasn't that likely that he was one of the people witnessing the Berlin Wall in the first 5% of its lifetime. That if the Berlin Wall actually became a feature for thousands of years, he'd be one of those lucky people who had seen it right back at the beginning. And again, he might be, but it's not that likely. So anyway, he did some maths around using Bayesian probability, which is it's a slightly tricksy form of probability. It's useful in scientific hypotheses. And he came up with a prediction that the Berlin Wall would probably be down by 1993. And it came down in 88, 89, 90. And he's quite well known for this. This was so based on the single observation that he happened to be in Berlin, seeing the Berlin Wall in 1969, he deduced that it would probably come down before 1993, which actually at the time most people thought was pretty soon. And astonishingly, he was right. He then did a whole thing of predicting how long shows would last on Broadway. And so moving on to obviously more and more important things. And also the lifetime of the human race, which has all kinds of caveats and things around it. And it depends on whether you're counting the number of people or how long they're around for. But this Copernican principle says you're nothing special, and applied to time, it says if you're observing something, if you were to be right in the first 10% of its lifetime or the last 10% of its lifetime, that will be a bit surprising. Now, some of the time you will be, so it is absolutely not hard and fast. And also, you can refine it. You can say, yeah, I know I have a reason to believe I'm around at the beginning of this thing because I invented it, or for some other thing. So this, it's more that this is the first guess, which additional information can then refine. So our timeline is that I'm teaching you with some hope that it will be useful in the future, about relational databases and and also about semi-structured data. So relational databases, relational database management systems go back to 1970. We're here at 2011. So they've been around for 41 years. So the chances are, if you do the maths, if we say we're probably not, okay, so the likelihood that you are the very last people who will ever get to use a relational database is quite low, because they've been around a while. And if you do the probability, the suggestion is that they're probably going to be, it will be a bit surprising if they did not last longer than about 4.5 years from now. So there's a really good chance that by the time you graduate, it will still be relevant to know about relational databases. That's good. If you go the other way, they're probably going to be around for not more than half a millennium. XML is, so this is a bit tricky, but I'm trying to get a date for it. XML, the first fairly settled standard for it was in 1997, at which point it was immediately useful. It was capturing something that had been around. So XML, as a language of semi-structured data, has been around for 14 years, which means that there's a pretty good chance it's going to last at least another 18 months. So, which is good, right? You can get you through the exam anyway. But it's worth bearing these things in mind. These are not going to be around forever. And even that, you know, something's been around for 40 years, I think, given the way computing goes, it's pretty settled. But there may yet be changes that come and surprises. And as I say, this is not hard and fast. This is just the first cut that you might then refine based on additional information about it. But it's a reasonable thing to kind of reflect on and say, no, there's, and certainly it's highly likely that one of the technologies that you'll learn about as being contemporary and a good thing to learn about while you're here will have completely vanished by the time you graduate. That's kind of normal. And the Copernican principle says that's not to be surprised at. That's not surprising. It will just happen sometimes. Luckily, to some extent, the principles underlying these things, the appreciation of the differences between them, the trade-offs, why XML is in fact incredibly popular and has been used and grown enormously since it was created, is useful and that does persist. So it might not be XML that you deal with, but there will be something, there will be approaches and solutions to the kind of problems that it is trying to treat. Right. Oh, and I owe you some Greek letters as well. But most of these you already know. I can find them. Pi we did for projection. It's also a very popular number. Capital Pi. Rho. This was used for row renaming and things to do with R, generally. Sigma, tau, and upsilon. Sigma has this really nice capital form. So sigma, pi, and rho get used quite a lot. Sort of pi, rho, and sigma get used quite a lot in mathsy things because they're pronounceable. Pi is like a P, rho is like an R, sigma is like an S. But they don't look like the letter you normally use. And so that you can easily reach for them and use them to describe a thing that you've run out of real letters for, or run out of Roman letters for. Tau is less useful because although there are lots of things like time that involve T-ness, it looks a bit too like a regular T. So in fact, a small tau is just basically a little small capital T, but it's usually written with a flick to indicate it's somehow different. And upsilon is even worse, because that just looks like a U. And it's usually written in some way, maybe without the downward stroke to indicate that it's different, but is extremely hard to spot in typography. So those are useful Greek letters. Next time we do some strange ones, then we'll be done. Right, XML, the extensible markup language. The extensible part refers to the fact that it's somewhat flexible. It's a generalization of rather more specific markup languages, in particular HTML for describing web pages. HTML is a markup language that's very fixed. XML is a more flexible markup language. And it has its origin in general markup languages. So I talked about corpora. Markup languages where you have some existing document, some existing piece of information, usually very unstructured, and you want to annotate it in some way. You want to mark it up. So this comes from, preparing a text for publication or editing by somebody else or turning into to printed typeface, you might have a handwritten document which is marked up. It has little annotations to say, put this in italics, make this bold, this is the heading, put the figure here and so on. That's known as markup. You take original text and then you mark it up with extra annotations. And this is the computer-based analog of it, where you have a plain piece of text or document of some kind, and you want to add some annotations about it. And the annotations might be to do with presentation, they might be to do with semantic content, with the meaning, they might be metadata, they might be provenance, they might be where something came from, or how much confidence you have in a particular piece of it, or alternative versions. You may have a document which has a historical document that has several sources that disagree, and so you might record alternative versions in the annotations. And that kind of application was used in a thing called a standard general markup language, which was a very extremely general scheme. The hypertext markup language HTML was a particular instance of that. And then XML is a generalization of HTML, but not as general as HTML. These are all attacking similar problems, and their success is sometimes just contingent on when they happen to be, where and when they happen to be invented. XML, it's text-based. This means it's moderately human readable. You can read an XML-based document. However, if it has a lot of markup in it, then it may not be particularly useful to read it. So Microsoft Word can emit, if you have a structured document in Microsoft Word, it can emit it as XML. It can save it in an XML format. But But if you look at it, you'll find almost all of it is annotation. There's a small amount which is the text you wrote, and then an enormous quantity is about the history of how you edited it, what you did it, what the settings on your machine were when you created it, and lots of annotation information. So it's readable, but not particularly readable. The real reason that it's, well, that, and that helped for it taking off, but the real reason it's kind of text-based and sort of readable is that it's then easily readable by machines. It's quite a forgiving format. If you add or drop spaces, if you rearrange lines, or if you rearrange things a little bit, it'll probably get through okay. It doesn't depend on bits appearing in exact positions. So it's text-based, which is useful for automatically generating it from programs and communicating between two different programs. So it's a reasonably forgiving format. And like SQL queries, the vast majority of XML data is sent by one machine and read by another. It is not looked at by humans at all. It's not even converted to some human readable format later. And there is a kind of XML, there's a lot of XML provided on the web, and web pages are just one example of it. Typically, I don't know that we have this on the next page. Yeah, if you want to present some data on the web, so not just information, the human readable information like a newspaper, but if you want to present some data like population statistics or government expenditure, then XML is the format you'll put it in. So XML is web pages for data, which interestingly is actually the original intention by Berners-Lee of the web, was that it should carry scientific data. The fact that it does carry some things of general human interest these days is a side effect. The web was invented for data. So this is what XML looks like. This is the original, the gazetteer we had before, but represented in as XML text. And again, if you read it, because this is a familiar kind of situation, you can see the sort of thing that's going on. It's a gazetteer, it talks about countries. One country has a name, Slovenia, has a population, a capital. It contains a region with certain features as well. And so this is the slightly abstract model of XPath turned into a text file. And there are all kinds of concrete things about exactly what. So here we have some indentation in the text file, which is giving you an idea of what's nested inside what else. That's not important. Actually, XML is completely insensitive to the presence of white space. Oh, no, it's not. The meaning of the document does not depend on the white space. Even if this wasn't indented, the region would still be a subpart of the gazetteer. Features, so we have some things in angle brackets, some things not in angle brackets. The things not in angle brackets are those leaf nodes that would appear at the bottom of the tree of text. Things inside angle brackets are nodes of particular kinds. Right, so if I do... No, wrong way around. Because I then have to go through the video afterwards and work out whether I made what put this to work or completely screwed up. And then next time I'll be doing some completely other manipulation in an attempt to get it right. So this is an XML document, and within it we have the elements corresponding to the nodes, and element is represented by the name of the element in angle brackets, and then the end of it, and that surrounds a region of text, and the end is marked with this end tag slash element. And then inside that, you have to have nested elements. So this is a way to take a tree and represent it in a text document. You say the top node is the gazetteer, and that includes everything. Then there's a country. The country begins here, ends here, and there may be other countries here. And then these are the nodes within the country, and one of them is the region. That contains a subtree, so it begins here and ends here. Whereas capital begins here and ends here and only has a single piece of text inside it. So this is a way of taking a tree representation and putting it in a text document. And it's close enough that you can go the other way, that given a document like this, it's not hard to have a machine visualize this is the tree that we're looking at. And indeed, you get libraries for walking around a tree structure like this. You say, here's an XML document. Tell me where is this node and what are the subnodes of it and so on. So nodes have to be, elements must be properly nested, otherwise they wouldn't really represent a tree. And things are case sensitive. The content of the capital element is just that text string inside. It has no sub-elements, whereas the region element has a number of sub-elements. If you have an empty element, which does not appear here, but it could do, you could have a country for which you have no information at all, then you can represent it as, you can put those two together and represent it
as a backslash afterwards.
Now, remember, the XPath data model had regular nodes, leaves, and then some nodes that were leaves but were kind of strongly attached to the one above them, and they were attributes. There's ones in the XPath that are represented with at. Here, they appear in a different place. So subnodes normally appear inside the bracketing, so the region contains several subnodes. But attribute nodes appear inside the angle brackets where you have the attribute and its value. And you can have several attributes for any given node. So the attribute here, this feature has attribute type, and the value of the type is mountain. And you can have more than one attribute on a single element. So you can have an element with attribute 1 has value 1, attribute 2 has value 2, and so on. And if you're familiar with the source of HTML, then you'll recognize this kind of thing as having, here is a paragraph, and the attribute might be the formatting of it, or where it's positioned on the page. So this is closely related to HTML. It takes a lot of the things that people liked about HTML, the fact that it's human readable, and to some extent human writable. It doesn't depend too much on the text layout and so on. It doesn't have, so Haskell programs, right, have the offside rule, which is just as complicated as you might expect, to do with determining scoping. And when it works, it's really nice, and when it doesn't, it can throw you a bit. And consciously, XML does not have anything like that. It's just a stream of text, and the exact layout doesn't matter. All of the content is to do with this bracketing of the angle brackets and one thing enclosing another. And we can get between them. So the fact that you have a root element and that everything is nested properly means that from an XML document, you can get to the tree structure. Every element in the XML document, and remember, an element can be quite a large thing here. Region is an element. It contains some sub-elements. Every element corresponds to an element node in an interior node of the XPath tree. The root element gazetteer here corresponds to the root element of the tree, not the very top one that's marked slash to begin everything with. The text content inside a node, such as this feature contains Spick, or the name here contains Gorenchka, or the population 2 million to 20,000, they correspond to a child node in the tree, where I said the actual data resided. That's kind of the data, and then the structure is on top of it. And an attribute definition, like the fact that Triglav is a mountain, corresponds to that child node that said at type equals mountain. So there's an exact correspondence between the tree model and XML. And certain things are ignored. So the text layout is ignored when you move to the tree model, but the order of the nodes and subnodes is kept. In the tree model, when you draw a tree, you have particular positions on the page. That's lost when you go back to XML. So if you were to make the round trip, if you took a graph, if you did some graphing tool, you drew up an XPath tree, you then converted to XML and then back again, it might not look exactly the same because the textual position, the spatial position of the nodes is not important, but their relative positioning is. And similarly, if you make the round trip from an XML to some graphical visualization back to XML again, you might lose some of the indentation there, because that's not important to the meaning of it. The meaning of it is what gets preserved through these transformations. So I said that whereas XPath is we have the data model and we have the concrete thing. The concrete part means that there's lots of additional bits and pieces that are specific to the standard of XML, and you will need to know about if you're actually writing code to process it or analyze it, but it's somehow not absolutely intrinsic to the scheme of it. And so there are things like comments. You can have comments inside an XML document, and those are done with angle brackets, exclamation mark, minus, minus, and end with minus, minus, greater than. And then they contain any text, but they can't contain minus, minus, because then that might look like the comment's ending. And there are all kinds of things like that about which sequences of characters may or may not appear in order to ensure the system is unambiguous. And not just that the document is unambiguous, but that if you start processing it partway through, you can generally get the hang of what's going on within a few characters. Or that if you lose a piece in the middle, it won't invalidate the whole of the rest of the document. There are lots of these kind of specific considerations that it's important to get right, but is somehow not intrinsic to semi-structured data. XPath data model can also have comment nodes. And things called processing instructions and declarations of data types and so on, which we're not going to consider here. There's a whole raft of things that have been tagged onto XML and onto the XPath data model in order to cope with particular idioms, particularly useful processing situations, but they're not that... They're obviously important in the situation where they're used, but they're not a generality. They're just instances of sometimes you have to fix things to make it work in the real world.
Okay, and I think, so I have, there's a couple of things about Unicode and well-formed document, which are these technicalities about how it works, and I'll talk about those next time. But the main structure is that we have these, we're not talking about highly structured data in rectangles, we're talking about semi-structured data, which is often best arranged as trees, and XPath is the model for it, and XML is the concrete syntax. Next time we shall see more about XML. If you could read chapter 2 of this handout before Friday, this will be really helpful. Thanks.